Hello, my name is Dan Brown, and I am here today again with another A Lens a Day, Conversations about Information Architecture. And today, it is my great pleasure to talk to the very sharp Stephanie Walter. Stephanie, thank you for joining me.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Did I say your name correctly? I said it like an American.
Yes, you did.
And I know. Stephanie. Okay, Americans sometimes do funny things with names. So, Stephanie, thanks for joining me. We have been following each other on Twitter for a while. And as someone who likes making decks of cards, I was excited to see that you had made a deck of cards. Nothing gives me greater pleasure than seeing people make decks of cards. Yours were about cognitive biases, right, that you had done with a friend or a partner. And I'm curious, how have you seen cognitive biases influence your process? Maybe you can talk to us a little bit about sort of the role that you've been using, or the way you've been using cognitive biases in doing the design process.
Yeah. So actually, it's quite related to the card deck we created, because we saw this kind of a super long list of cognitive biases on Wikipedia, like more than 100, but not all of them always apply in the design process. So when we created the cards, we kind of cherry-picked the one that might kind of happen or influence design, and we split it into five categories. So we have decision-making and behavior biases, which is things that might influence your users in the way they are going to take decisions. So usually this is more like e-commerce things, when you want people to take decisions, you want to help them buy things, or maybe you can use that in health tech, for instance, if you want people to take better health decisions, things like that. We have thinking, so and problem solving. This is more about kind of how do people, again, think about their daily lives and stuff like that. Memory and recalling. And the one that I'm particularly concerned about those days is interview and user testing bias, and all the biases that might happen with teamwork, social, and meetings, even if we are on Zoom meetings at the moment or whatever tool we're using, because I'm still working remotely. So interview biases is a really complex one, and I think it's one of the most interesting ones, because I'm really trying to kind of teach or make my teams aware of this kind of stuff. So to give you an example, like if you're going to ask people questions, there's a bias that is called social desirability bias, which is people tend to give you the most kind of socially okay answer. So it's okay if you're asking really generic stuff, but it might happen, like if you ask people, do you like the design, and you just told them before you're the designer, there's a good chance they're not going to tell you they hate it. So they're, again, like biased towards telling you, yeah, they basically like did the design. I can't really tell them the truth. And it gets a little bit worse if you go into like really specific topics like health or sexuality, or kind of topics that are sometimes really personal and things like that. And then sometimes people tend to give the most kind of common answer that, you know, the answer that they would expect everyone to give, and not really be honest with you. And maybe they don't even kind of see that they're doing that. It's just kind of a way we tend to behave into society. So this is the kind of stuff. And as a kind of UX designer who's doing usability testing, there's a confirmation bias, which is, I think, the most horrible for us as designers, which is we tend to try to confirm our hypothesis. So when you're doing tests, you tend to maybe take kind of more interest, or maybe notice more everything that the user is saying that is going towards what you expect, what is going to confirm that your design is actually good. Or if you want to prove that this is an old design, it's not good, everything that the user is going to say that says, oh, this is shit, like, yeah, I'm going to write that down. And then you might miss a few things. So this is really, really horrible bias to kind of get rid of. I don't think we can get rid of it. This is usually why we work with a few bunch of people, so that everyone in the room can check everyone's biases or things like that. So yeah, there's a lot of fields involved, and as soon as you work with human beings, of course. That's that a was, fun part.
That was great. One of the things that I don't know if this is considered a cognitive bias, but one of the things that we in the IA world think a lot about, or that comes up a lot, is something called the paradox of choice, right? This idea that, or the expectation that when we give people more choices, they will be happier because they have more to choose from. But it turns out that when we give people a lot to choose from, they become paralyzed, right? They become unable to make a choice because it's overwhelming, the amount of choice that they have. And I know you're dealing a lot with enterprise design designing products for the enterprise. Certainly when I've done that, when I've done intranets and things like that, the expectation is, well, we'll just put a big list of things so that people have a nice long list. Have you encountered this?
We have that, actually. We have we come from a really big interface where we have 400 pages. And the reason we have 400 pages is because the business is really siloed. And some information is on like 3 or 4, or even like 5 or 10 of those pages. You have the same information at different places. And we are trying to avoid that in the new one. So we are trying to actually organize the information. We did some card sorting with some users when I was I didn't do that. It was the guy who worked there before me, but I still have the results of the card sorting and things like that. So we have this kind of a lot of choice, and it's complicated because I think for 90% of the users, the new architecture is fine because they don't want to find specific things at the same place. But we have this kind of really specific user group who are only interested in this information, this and this. And we kind of foresee in the new design, and we've already seen that in the usability tests we are doing, that those kind of users, they're not super happy about having to go to 3 different places now to find the information. So we had feedback like, so the design is really card oriented. It's a lot of small little cards with basically bank data. And we had people who say, can't I just like have one big page and a catalog of all the cards and you let me choose and I build my own page? So I think it's interesting because we have to be careful. You have like a wide range or spectrum of complexity for the users. And this is a banking interface. It's an interface to basically handle project from the beginning of the project, contract drafting, to giving the money to different kind of areas, to following what's happening to the money, to disbursement and reimbursement. So really complex business. And yeah, if it works for some of those users, maybe we are going to build that. So at some point we are like, yeah, we can build something that will work for, I don't know, 80% of the people, 90%. But for those 10 really advanced users, maybe at some point, we actually need to give them the choice. But I'm always kind of wary about people who say, I want to customize everything. As soon as you have this, like, I think MySpace learned it the really hard way. It's like a lot of people wanted to customize stuff. They build this super heavy stuff where you customize everything. And if you actually look at people, do you end up discovering that most people just stick with the default? And that's a bias, by the way. It's like most people will stick with the default. So you need to be super smart and super careful about defaults. But yeah, at some point we have kind of both kind of users, the ones who will be okay with the defaults and the ones who may need super complex advanced choices. And we have to kind of find a way to make both user groups happy. So we'll see. We're not there yet.
Right.
But at some point this might happen.
Yeah, I also have developed a very healthy skepticism of people saying, well, we'll just let users customize. I'm working with a product now where the stakeholders are like, well, we want it to be a personalized experience. And, you know, you and I know the gap, you know, the amount of energy that it would require to make something personalized. So my instinct is let's make a good default experience so that as you're working on the personalization, you know, that at least you've got something to work from. You had mentioned card sorting, and it's great to hear that that was part of the research. Are there other IA kind of activities or methods or tools that you really like when you're working on these kind of big enterprise apps?
At the moment, big part of my job is trying to make sense of the data. So I'm doing a lot of, I'm not even sure who to name that, like information architecture mapping and or like content modeling, basically. Understanding, like I have to design three tables. And when you see those tables in the screen, you're like, oh my God, what's going on there? And then what I usually do, I start like just, I screenshot the table, I throw them into mirror board, and I just like put little post-it notes or just like little rectangle. And by doing so, I actually discovered that the structure of three of those tables is basically the same. So I'm like, oh, okay, now I can make sense of this mess. And I have the same thing for a lot of the pages, like, you see the page, you get scared, like really, really get scared. We have people who say, I never use that page. It's too complicated. I can't find any information. Like at some point, I even opened the HTML because the page has, I don't know how many levels of nested objects into it. And I was hoping like maybe in the HTML, I can see the divs and the H1, 2, 3, 4, 5 levels, but no, they put divs everywhere. So I'm like, oh gosh, how am I supposed to make sense of what belongs to the parent, what belongs to that part? So yeah, I end up doing a lot of those kind of mappings because for me, it helps me structure the content. And also I usually give that to the dev team because they also need to structure the content as well in the browser. So usually a lot of the things that I kind of end up doing is this kind of big maps, either flowcharts or basically content models. And all of that is something that I put into Jira stories to my devs as well, because I discovered it helps them tremendously. Like same for user flow and things like that, or task flow where we are just like mapping different steps and things like that.
That kind of analysis, I feel like, is, and this may be just old man Dan talking, but I almost feel like it's a little bit of a lost art. Like there's not the same level of attention that people can give that kind of stuff to really dig into those complexities. And so it's nice to hear that it's kind of part of the process, really, to try and model and understand.
Don't have
the
a
content.
Choice.
How else are we going to design it? Yeah.
Like, I don't have a choice. But we're working with a design system and we're building it, actually. And the idea of the design system is to make super reusable components. And in order to do super reusable components, I need to have a really, really solid structure. And I need to make basically sure that the structure that I'm going to use for one component could be kind of reused for another component and maybe for another one. So this is also why I'm doing this super heavy lifting, which is about finding what things look alike, like what are the things that have the same structure, what looks enough alike so that we can use the same component to avoid, like, again, what I think they did in the old one, which is every single page has its own structure of data front on the page and things like that. So I think if you're working with like complex data tables with, I have a friend working in insurance and it's the same, like bank insurance, CRM, intranets, all of those super complicated things, you need to have kind of a crystal clear structure. Otherwise, you can build reusable components. So this is why also kind of my work is deeply linked, and it's kind of a little bit weird that I'm doing like user research, but also design system and information architecture at the same time. But at the end of the day, everything is linked, like understanding user needs, to understand the data, the structure, to build reusable components. Everything is kind of a circular process at some point.
I'm going to ask you, I think what might be a hard question, but that's the whole point of this, is to sort of, is to really try and understand how does IA work, right? That's why I'm interviewing all these people. Mm. When you make an effort to understand an underlying structure, what is it that you are looking for, right? If you're sort of, I'm picturing you pulling these three tables into Miro and starting to annotate them to really try and understand what's going on under the surface. What are the structures of these tables? Mm. What is it that you think you are doing? How would you describe sort of what you're looking for?
Similarities, because as I said, we try to reuse the components, and we are not going to design 100 different tables. So the idea is I need to find a way to design one table that is flexible enough and that is going to be able to go into different directions. And the fun part is I have 20 columns in the table. So, and this is a small one. Like I have a table, I think there's 40 tables in, and it's just like 40 columns, and it's basically like wrapping on different rows. It's really complicated. But yeah, similarities. Also making, kind of trying to understand, especially for tables, understanding the data. For instance, we have some dates somewhere in the table. So the question here, I have like two columns, one which is a beginning date and one which is end date. The question is, couldn't we basically merge those into one column? So have maybe one cell with the two dates. And then it's also about what are users going to do with that. So the question is, when you have such a big table, what you want to do is you want to see if you can actually, what do users need to do that? Do they need to compare the columns? But then do they need to compare all of those columns? Or at some point, can we make it so that if they don't need some of the column, maybe we hide them by default, and then you provide a mechanism, usually a dropdown with little checkboxes, so that users can show them again. And for this table, the fun part is 90% of the time when you have data for 8 columns, the rest is like really specific edge cases. If you have penalties on a contract because they forget to reimburse some of the part and it's late and stuff like that. And like, I think maybe 80% of our data today can work with 8 rows. The question is, how do you design a table that usually needs to work with 8 rows, but sometimes at some point you might need 20 of those. So that's the kind of stuff I'm trying to really understand the structure and really understand how we might make that work, and also how we might make that work on a super small screen, because half our user will have a 2080 pixel screen. Half of them. I don't know why. It's a default Windows resolution and it's quite bad.
Interesting. Well, I think this may be a good time to talk a little bit about the lens that we picked for you. I mean, the way you're talking about tables is, you know, there's looking for the structure, there's looking for ways to make it to consolidate a little bit, right? To kind of tighten it up, right? But at the same time, you want to convey to the user that everything that they need is there, right? That you haven't sort of hidden anything. You want to, in a sense, make them feel like you haven't, that you're not deceiving them at all. So why don't you tell us what lens we picked, and maybe if you want, describe it in your own words, or at least talk about what it means to you. That makes me feel so good when you pick up the card like that.
I don't know if you see it properly. Yes. The webcam needs to do the white thing. So yeah, I chose the confidence lens. So it's each step through the structure should build the user's confidence about where they are going. User don't mind an extra step if they feel confident about their direction. I picked it because of the extra step, actually. Because while working on the navigation, we had some users who are basically like counting the numbers of clicks. And it's really weird at some point, but you have to understand that some people do the same thing all over again all day long. So they use the interface to enter repeating data and things like that. So yeah, one extra click is going to be a little bit annoying if you have to repeat this one extra click, I don't know, 20 times a day or something. But I also like the part about confidence, because actually we ended up counting with the users. So we moved around some things in the navigation, and we were kind of beaten by legacy. So in the old architecture, they mixed potatoes and apples. So you have a navigation on the left and you have potatoes, apples, everything is mixed. So it's a super long, super big navigation. And in the new one, we decided that potatoes are potatoes, apples are apples. At some point, you can jump from one potato to an apple if you need to, because reasons. But we kind of created two separate pages for those. But at some points, when users are looking at apples, they want to see something specific in the potatoes. And in the old one, since you had everything in the left menu, you could really quickly go there. So the idea is now, how do you make sure that people understand that? So the fun part is, we had people say, yeah, but it's a lot more clicks. So they kind of lost confidence. But if we did the whole kind of user flow with them, it was the same exact number of clicks. But since they didn't click on the same thing, it felt to them as something new. So I'm like, no, look, we can count like 1-2 clicks away. And when we go to the old one, it's like, yes, 1-2 clicks away. It's just that they didn't click on the same thing because the menu changed. And so they were a little bit lost. So we changed a few things. We didn't mix apples and potatoes again. This is like the one big thing we tried to avoid. But at some point, we also added some internal links to make it quicker to navigate from one thing to the other. So I think it's about mostly like helping people understand that, yes, it's a big change. And of course, acknowledging also that it will take them a little bit of time to get used to that. And I think that's the weirdest thing working in enterprise UX is I talk to the users a lot. This is not the weird part, but we have users who actually expect training. So, you know, this horrible joke, like a good interface is like a good joke. If you have to explain it, it's bad. I hate that. I think it's the worst metaphor ever. Like, but in enterprise UX, basically you have people who expect training. So we are doing the training for the people who want to. So this is the kind of weird thing. It's like, it's a tool. So you have to train people on that. Not everyone. We have people who say, oh, I don't need training, it's fine. But we also have some users who will never click on a link if they didn't go through a training that's telling them what this link is going to do. So we have this kind of range of people who say, yeah, if we need training, it means it's complicated. I don't want any training, versus people who actually want it. So we make the training not mandatory. So if you want some training, we're here. If you have a question, you can, like, we're basically doing customer support on that one as well. You can come to us. And by doing this small little trainings and just like showing them, yeah, look, you can still find it in this way. It's same numbers of click, or if you open in a new tab now, which is possible because in the old way you could not, it's even one less click, then it's actually working. But it's a weird thing, like I didn't expect people actually counting numbers of clicks and clicks, but also keyboard navigation as well.
I mean,
like, we have a lot of forms and people are like, yeah, I want to never use the mouse for that. I'm like, tab entering data, tab entering data, tab entering data, entry done.
Yeah.
Okay. Challenge accepted.
I mean, the counting clicks. I mean, Stephanie, I've been doing this for 25 years, more. I've been doing this work since 1995. And we've been counting clicks for that long. And it is, it's amazing that that is still a measure. But as you say, in an enterprise setting where a single click can add, you know, an enormous burden to a repetitive task, it may not be unreasonable. I need to ask, and this is only because I'm obsessed with language. In French, when you say compare apples and potatoes, like, do you say compare apples and potatoes in the French, or is that just a Stephanie thing? Because in English, in American English, you say we're going to compare we're jumping from apples to oranges, but you said apples to potatoes.
No, I was just
that's just
a, I was looking just, for a,
you're just picking produce out of the air.
Yeah, I think we have something in French. I don't remember. But it's ne pas mélanger les torchons et les serviettes. But it's you can't mix. It's the same word in English for both.
Well, that was an interesting, that was an interesting detour. I was working on an international team earlier this year, and we all compared the idiom that we use for to kill two birds with one stone. And apparently this is different everywhere in the world. So I was just curious about apples and potatoes. Thank you for going down that little road with me.
I usually use carrots. I don't know why I'm too.
Oh, no. Well, today. it's another root vegetable. I get that. One of the things that I've been asking folks is, how would you teach someone how to use this lens? And I'm genuinely curious about this because I feel like a lot of folks who are entering the business today don't have the same depth of experience, don't get to kind of think as deeply about the design problems as people who've been around for a while, that there's a greater emphasis on pushing out screens than there is in kind of thinking, taking the time to think deeply about the problem. So I want to help people understand, what does it mean to use this lens of confidence? What does it mean to look at your work through this lens? How might you advise someone or coach someone who's working on a complicated design problem to use this lens?
I would tell them to try to go through the different steps someone needs to go to find their information. I would say if they can do like some task observation with users, that would be amazing. Because you can't really like ask a user, is the menu well structured, things like that. So usually you want to do like observation, I would say. So I think it's always interesting. And one small exercise I like to do with that is try to make my teams aware that mental models are not the same for everyone, especially with different cultures. So I usually ask them to tell me what's the steps you expect in an ATM. Because if you're in France or in Luxembourg, the steps are not the same. Like the moment they ask for your PIN code in Luxembourg, I think it's quite around the end. While in France, the first thing you ask is PIN code when you're, it depends on the ATM, but most of the time. So usually do this small exercise to help people understand that what they think is the perfect, basically, way might not be the same for the users. So that's usually something that is quite interesting to play around as well, I think.
That's great. It was interesting to me that you talked about confidence in terms of when I wrote the lens, what I was thinking about is, what can I do as a designer with the labels or with the descriptive text or things in the UI to build the user's confidence so that they feel confident about what they're clicking on? What you said was, working in enterprise software, there's sometimes the expectation of training, and where that confidence comes from is not the UI, it's not the design, it's the fact that they've been trained on something.
For some users,
That's
the weird part.
Has that affected your design process at all?
Kind of, yeah, but this is also why I try to bring the design as soon as possible in front of some users to double check that. And sometimes we will just like show a page to someone who is in our beta user group just to double check and things like that. But most of the time, like we get nice feedbacks. The story with the clicks, we don't have that many people who, for the moment, said there were a lot of clicks. But I also think it has to do with reactants or things like that. So because the user group who said the number of click changed is a group where we kind of did something which maybe should not have, which is we said we are going to decommission one specific page of the old architecture to kind of motivate them to use the new one. And this is when we got all the feedbacks about numbers of clicks and all of that. So I think it's also a little bit linked with a fear of change, which is again related to confidence. How confident am I that I'm going to be able to do my job with this brand new interface I'm not used to yet? But I think it always takes a while. Like a lot of people don't like change. And here again, it's not a brand new product. It's people who are used to do things a certain way. Some of those people have been doing that for the 10 last years. So changing navigation, obviously, it might be a little bit more complicated. So we have a lot of things. We have a color code for the apple and versus the potatoes. Obviously, I am not. I don't have apples and potatoes. It's just easier to explain that way. But we have apples one color, potatoes another one. So unless you're colorblind, but also we have some icons for those different things. So there's a lot of different ways that we are again trying to bring information. And but I think the complicated part is that we change a few things also. And about confidence is people might be a little bit lost at the beginning. So I have not necessarily users, but people who are more into the IT side who asked for tooltips over everything. It's like, yeah, but we totally need to do a tooltip on that and on that so that people know what he's going to do. It's like, yes, or we can just like let them discover. And it's okay if they don't find it right away in the 2 first seconds. Like I had people who we gave them the interface, we observed them using it. It took them 2 minutes to find something. But when we asked, they said, okay, I didn't see it because it was basically at the bottom of the screen. But now that I know it's there, it's not a problem anymore. So do we need onboarding for that? I'm not sure. Do we really need a kind of, you know, these wayfinding when you arrive, you have a whole guide of the interface? The person found the information in less than 2 minutes. It's like first-time usage for me into an enterprise software that they are going to use on a daily basis, maybe for the next years. That's kind of acceptable delay or something. So I think sometimes we are so afraid and maybe we also lack confidence in our own design that maybe we just like, we're trying to throw those... So, you know, like those security things you send when people are on a boat, not security nets. I don't remember the name in English.
Life preservers. Yeah.
Yes, those we try maybe too quickly. And it's also about if you have a new interface, it's about discovering it maybe by yourself if you don't do the training. So it's fine. So not putting tooltips on everything, if it's possible, I think. Should be a little bit better. In my context of enterprise UX, of course.
Of course. Stephanie, that was great. I think we will leave it there. Thank you so much.
Thank you.